Fred Clair spent 30 years as a prominent figure on one of baseball's most regal franchises, and an integral part in leading the Dodgers to a world championship in 1988. But before joining the Dodgers, Fred, your background included stints as a sports writer and editor. How did that experience in the journalism field help you in your relationship with the media as a public relations executive and eventually as a general manager?
Well, I think more than anything, it was my exposure to baseball, really to all sports. And the reason that I got involved in journalism or became a journalism major was because I wanted to stay connected with sports. Because for as long as I can remember, as a youngster, I had a great love for sports. I had a great love for baseball, for basketball, growing up in a small town in Ohio. And I realized that my athletic ability was only going to take me so far. So what I wanted to do was to find a path to stay connected. And I thought it would either be as a coach or, as I then was to later discover, an opportunity with journalism and writing about sports. And so that interest came somewhat early for me. I competed in basketball and baseball in high school, but also took journalism classes. I wrote for the student newspapers that I was involved with. And ultimately, that led me to college with a degree from San Jose State as a journalism major, and that led me into sports writing field, became a sports editor at a relatively young age, and ultimately, and I suppose more specific to answer the question, the opportunity to join the Dodgers as director of publicity in 1969.
Now, the Dodger organization, when you were there, was known for stability with its managers, its general managers, ownership under the O'Malleys, and of course its current broadcaster. How important is that continuity to the success of a franchise, and why don't we see more of it today?
Well, it was very important for the Dodgers. We had a farm director, a longtime farm director by the name of Bill Schweppe, a wonderful man who joined the Dodgers during the time, really, of the Branch Rickey era. And I once asked Bill, I said, Bill, with all of your years with the Dodgers, what would you say would be one of the key components to the success that the organization has had through the years? And he answered rather quickly and concisely, and he said, continuity. So when you look at the Dodgers during the time that I started and for most of the years that I was there, we had, when you look at certainly the visible part of the organization, the team, we had two managers over, I guess, 40 years, Walter Alston, Tommy Lasorda. We had two ticket managers, two or three stadium operation managers, two or three general managers. So it wasn't only in baseball, but in all departments. And that was a philosophy of the O'Malley family in running the organization with the basic philosophy that the success of the organization and of the team is a matter of people working together and not necessarily one person being responsible for the success, in other words, in judging a manager, but in the combined efforts, because it takes the combined efforts to be successful, certainly in baseball, your scouting, your player development, your coaches, your manager, your general manager, all the people involved. So that really, it was a philosophical part. Today, certainly not just with the Dodgers, because you had now had several changes of ownership, but with all organizations, higher visibility, certainly in all areas, more financial requirements needed, and it's simply a different structure. And, you know, there's always been the emphasis on winning, but you simply don't have the type of continuity that the Dodgers believed in at one time. Mm-hmm.
Another hallmark of the Dodgers has always been its ability to be at the forefront of reaching into untapped markets of players, most famously with African Americans and Jackie Robinson, but also with Latin America opening the first baseball academy there, and with the signing of Hideo Nomo from Japan in 1995. What made the Dodgers have such foresight?
I think a lot of the credit belongs to the to the O'Malley family, and certainly with the most significant step in Dodger history, and I think perhaps in baseball history, the view and the philosophy of the great and legendary Branch Rickey to give Jackie Robinson the opportunity that opened the doors for so many great players. I mean, I think that's is a real tribute to Branch Rickey and to the Dodgers, and to have that come about and really change not only the game itself, but just simply from a sociological standpoint, the changes and the impact. And I think that was tremendous. But beyond that, the Dodgers always, and certainly under the O'Malley's, always had the interest in international baseball. The Dodgers making trips to Japan with exhibition games, having the Tokyo Giants come to Dodger Town to train. And when I became the general manager, I'm very pleased, really, that I was there at a time when we had the opportunity to sign Hideo Nomo, which really changed what was taking place between Major League Baseball and Japanese baseball professionally. And I also was the general manager when we signed Chan-ho Park. So those were significant signings in terms of what they represented about opportunities for players from other parts of the world, and always an emphasis on Latin America, going back to days in Cuba, and certainly the Dodger efforts and the academy that was established in the Dominican Republic, which was really a model for great academies to develop, or improved academies. And I was very active when we established stronger working relationships in Venezuela. And we always had, we were always looking for opportunities in other areas. And the players that I've mentioned, and also, of course, the impact of what the signing of Fernando Valenzuela meant in terms of baseball in Mexico. So just always being open to opportunities. And I think that the record speaks for itself for the Dodgers during that period of time.
You were, for lack of a better term, the beneficiary of the infamous comments made by Al Campanis on Nightline in April of 1987 to mark the 40th anniversary of Jackie Robinson's debut, in which he said, among other things, that African Americans don't have the necessities to become field managers or general managers. He was forced to resign as GM, and you took his place. What do you remember about the immediate aftermath of that incident?
Well, the two parts of that that I think are important certainly from a historical standpoint. When Al Campanis went on Nightline and was asked, I don't remember the exact question, but why aren't there more minorities or blacks in position of authority in baseball, or as managers or as general managers? I think that Al was trying to defend the game and the sport that he loved, and in an area where there was really no defense. And because Al Campanis, the person, he was really instrumental and helpful to Jackie Robinson, I mean, and to the signing of Roberto Clemente. So I that was really a tragic set of circumstances for Al, but history has recorded it as history has recorded it, and that's just part of what took place. It created a firestorm, certainly, and at that time, Al was asked to resign, and Peter O'Malley, the owner of the team, he had been with the Dodgers for the opening of that 1987 season in Houston, and he called me from Houston. And he said, Fred, that I just accepted the resignation of Al Campanis. And he said, and his words were, you have to take this job. And I had been with the organization for 20 years, or nearly 20 years. And we came, Al and Peter O'Malley flew back from Houston. The next day was opening day at Dodger Stadium. And that's when I told Peter that I knew we were going through a very difficult time, but that if he wanted, and that I would be happy to serve in an advisory role, or if he wanted to take the time to look at somebody as a general manager, but if he was asking me to accept that position, that I would accept it. And the only thing that I asked for is what I felt was important to that, and that I would have full, total, complete responsibility for the baseball operations. And Peter stuck out his hand and said, I'm in agreement with that. And so that was my beginning as the general manager, although I had been involved in baseball operations from the standpoint of attending general manager meetings with Al, dealing with agents, dealing with all of our team personnel through the years, major league staff, scouting, player development, etc. So that was my start in 1987 as the general manager of the team. I had previously held the title of executive vice president, so I became executive vice president and general manager.
Soon after taking over, you certainly had your work cut out for you heading into the 88 season, coming off two straight 73-win seasons. But you made several key acquisitions, getting shortstop Alfredo Griffin and reliever Jay Howell from Oakland in the middle of the season, trading the disgruntled Pedro Guerrero for starter John Tudor. But the most significant move came in the offseason when you signed Kirk Gibson, once of the Detroit Tigers. He would eventually win the National League MVP in 88 and have a pretty big home run that October. What made you believe that he would be the right fit for the club?
Well, as you pointed out, going into 88, after the 87 and the 86 seasons, I think in both of those seasons, we were 16 games under 500. So we were far, far out of a competitive position. And I knew that there were several changes that we just absolutely had to make at team positions. We had to strengthen ourselves at shortstop. We had to have a closer, and we needed left-handed help in the bullpen. And in the winter meetings of 87, I was involved, and the Dodgers were involved with a three-way trade with Oakland and the New York Mets, whereby we acquired, as you mentioned, Alfredo Griffin to be our shortstop, who was to do a great job in solidifying our defense, Jay Howe, who proved to be a tremendous closer force, and Jesse Orozco, who we acquired from the Mets in that three-man trade to help with our left-handed help out of the bullpen. So actually at the winter meetings, if one looks back from a historical standpoint, one of the players that I had focused on was Kirk Gibson, who was with Detroit in the 87 season, but there was a lot of uncertainty as far as what was going to be happening, whether Kirk and other players might be declared as free agents during the 88 season after the collusion case and rulings. And so we didn't acquire. I had discussions with Bill LaJoy of Detroit, but then I believe it was in January of 88, with Kirk as a free agent, that everything that I knew about him from what I heard from our scouts, one scout in particular, a great, great scout who spent most of his time in amateur baseball, had seen Kirk at Michigan State, Dale McReynolds, who I talked to any number of times before I made the decision to sign Kirk as a free agent. And as you say, he went on not only to a memorable home run, but probably one of the few free agent signings who was to become that very next season the most valuable player of the National League.
1-2 pitch, right on through the catcher into the screen. Gibson comes to third. He's going to try to score. The play at the plate. He scores, and the ball game is over. Kirk Gibson on a wild pitch scores from second base. The Dodgers win 4-3.
Yeah, Gibson was certainly a main contributor, as was Oral Hershiser, who carried his record-setting scoreless streak through the end of the regular season and into an NLCS matchup with the Mets, who had beaten the Dodgers 10 out of 11 times during the year. Was Hershiser's remarkable streak alone enough to make you think that things would be different against New York this time?
Well, I simply believe in our team, and even though we had certainly struggled against the Mets, to say the least, we had a team that collectively just gained momentum overall throughout the season and really came together. The addition of Kirk clearly meant a lot, and with Alfredo stabilizing the infield, with Jay Howe closing the games, with Mike Socha and Steve Sachs making contributions, and then actually in one of my first moves, I think probably the first or the, maybe the second transaction that I ever made at the beginning of the 1987 season when I became the general manager, was to sign Mickey Hatcher, who had been released by the Minnesota Twins. I had known Mickey from his previous time with the Dodgers. And Mickey was a key factor because it really had to do with that team. It had a lot to do not only with talent, but it had to do with attitude. And also late in the 87 season, there was a pitcher with Oakland who had not reached the major leagues that from our reports that I liked a lot of what I was hearing. I had our scouts look at him thoroughly throughout the 87 season. And then I believe it was in September of 87, we acquired Tim Belcher, who was to play a major, major impact during the 1988 season. So it was a team that came together. And so when we faced the Mets in the championship series, despite the fact that we had really struggled, I know our team certainly had confidence. I think all of us involved had confidence that that this was going to be our year, and that's indeed what happened. We defeated the Mets, and of course went on to the World Series.
Yeah, Hershiser would be the NLCS MVP. Saved Game 4, had a shutout in Game 7, and that momentum carried into the World Series, upsetting the A's in 5 games. Gibson is only a bat in the series, hitting the game 1 home run. Hershiser won with complete games in game 2 and the game 5 clincher, and also won that MVP. We hear from players, the manager usually, about the satisfaction of winning the World Series. From a general manager's perspective, after making all those moves that paid off and led to the championship, how gratifying was that for you?
Well, it was gratifying for me and for the organization, because one has to keep in mind that at the beginning, really tough, tough seasons in both 86 and 87, and then the turmoil that we went through with Al Campanis going on Nightline and having to resign. And so as we, as the 88 season unfolded, and now as we entered postseason play with an opportunity to win the prize, of course, that the only prize that truly matters to win a World Series, the one thing I had in my mind was that I believe we can do this, and when we do it, the words that I wanted to use and did use was to be able to salute the work of the people in the Dodger organization, the scouts, the player development people, because we had come from such depths there, and I knew full well that for the organization, for its past and for its future, that it was going to be an opportunity to really bring us back to a level where we wanted to be, and to pay tribute to so many people who contribute so much to a baseball team.
Got him. They've done it. Like the 1969 Mets, it's the impossible dream revisited.
And I'd like to, if I can, to Peter O'Malley, you deserve this, Fred Flair?
Thank you, Commissioner. Tommy and Fred and I accept this, Commissioner, on behalf of the great team we have in the front office and on the field. We're very happy and we're very thankful. Thank you.
Of course, the manager of that 1988 club and the skipper for 21 seasons was Tommy Lasorda. He was also a player with the Dodgers, a minor league manager, stayed with the team even after retiring as manager. Certainly one of the most recognizable figures in all of baseball, not just with the Dodgers, and a gregarious personality as well. In the many years that you worked with him, what was he like behind the scenes? What was your relationship like with him?
Well, Tommy was, as everyone knows, was passionate about the game, competitive, always giving the best that he had to give, and always doing everything he could to encourage players, an expression that he often used and still uses is getting everybody on the same side of the rope or pulling together. And so my relationship with Tommy, I consulted Tommy on literally every move that that I made, that we made, because it's important for the manager to have input, I believe, in terms of the type of team that he's going to have, trying to fill the needs seen by the manager. And, of course, the general manager has that ultimate responsibility, as he should, and needs to take responsibility, as I always did. But Tommy was always about giving his best and wanting to win. And from that standpoint, our philosophies could not have been more in sync.
Another great thing that happened in 1988, although it certainly wasn't known at the time, was the drafting of newly named Hall of Famer Mike Piazza in the 62nd round. As the story goes, that was done as a courtesy from Tommy Lasorda to his friend and Mike's father, Vince. Was it purely a gesture, considering how late in the draft that occurred, or was there some knowledge of potential he might have?
No, it was not just a courtesy, because that's not the way that you really operate a baseball team. Mike had played college baseball. Tommy certainly knew of Mike and his family and was close to Mike's father, Vince. So there was, from that standpoint, there very definitely was awareness as far as this young man's desire to play the game. This young man's work habits and the talent of Mike, and certainly his work that he did in trying to be the best hitter that he could possibly be. So that was very definitely an awareness of the ability of Mike. Now, could anybody have projected, based on where Mike was selected, the type of career? Absolutely not. I mean, it's unprecedented. It's historic, but it's a tribute to the work that Mike put in.
That one is hit a mile. A majestic shot to the top of the bleachers out there. Wow! Number 37 for Piazza. And that one may be as long as he's ever hit one.
I can't think of one general manager who doesn't make a move that just eventually doesn't pan out. The signing of Daryl Strawberry in November of 1990, I think, qualifies as such. A Los Angeles native, he was the number one draft pick in 1980 by the Mets out of Crenshaw High School. He had expressed a desire to play in Los Angeles, even dating back to comments he made, I think, during the 88 NLCS. Obviously showed tremendous talent in New York, and you would think still had a lot of good years ahead of him. But there was a lot of talk about his off-the-field reputation, much of which would eventually come to fruition, unfortunately. Did you think signing him, bringing him to his hometown, would ultimately benefit him and quiet those rumors?
Well, I thought that, you know, when you look at Daryl, at the time that we signed Daryl, if you looked at his talent, his age, what he had accomplished, and to try to project that, that was a Hall of Fame path. Bringing him back to Los Angeles I thought was a great opportunity for us and for Darryl. And at the same time, along with that, making the trade to bring another young man with extreme talent back to Los Angeles, Eric Davis, in the trade with Cincinnati. So there was an opportunity there with two talented players at really still key ages in their careers to really do something of a great, great magnitude. In fact, a longtime baseball man, Joe Klein, who was the general manager of the Texas Rangers, remains active in baseball today with the Atlantic League, told me shortly after the signing, or maybe it was after that first season, he said, "Fred, when you acquired Darryl Strawberry and Eric Davis," he said, "I thought in my mind they're going to raise a world championship flag in Los Angeles with these two players." So that was the hope. Did it work? No, not to the degree that I had hoped for, and certainly not to the degree that both Darryl and Eric had hoped for. Darryl, I believe, in his first season had some success, but it never really developed, and Darryl did have off-the-field problems, absolutely no question of that. All of that has been well recorded, documented, part of history. So in many cases, it was unfortunate because there was a great, great opportunity. And also, just from a standpoint of as history unfolded, the things that were happening and the turmoil that was happening in South Central Los Angeles. So it was very unfortunate that neither player was able to achieve the type of success that one perhaps could have projected, and certainly that I projected in making the acquisition of those two players.
In 1994, you traded Pedro Martinez to the Montreal Expos in exchange for second baseman Delino DeShields. I think some critics, and I probably would be among those sometimes, are very nearsighted when they might say, like, how could he trade someone like Pedro Martinez? But it's not like you knew what he would become, of course. If you knew the type of pitcher Pedro would turn into, you obviously wouldn't have traded him. But even today, considering the needs you had at the time for an infielder, can you still justify making that trade?
Oh, no, I've never tried to justify making that trade. I mean, that would be foolish. History has recorded, and properly so, Pedro as a Hall of Fame player. And the one thing that didn't change about Pedro was the type of person that he was with us. So, you know, it's a case of looking back, a couple of things unfolded there. I wanted very much, first of all, to sign, and I don't say this as an excuse, this is a matter of fact, to sign Jody Reed, and made an incredible offer, 3-year offer to sign Jody. We also made a great effort to try to acquire Robbie Thompson, who was a free agent with the Giants. The Giants ultimately made the decision to keep Robbie and let Will Clark go, if my memory is correct. But it was a case of trying to do things, trying to fill a need for us, and also of the fact that Delino was a very good young player who projected a bright future in the game. But as far as what resulted, you as a general manager, at least in my philosophy, you take responsibility for each and every trade that you you make. Certainly in that case, it proved to be a very, very terrible trade for us because Pedro went on to a great, great career that certainly could have been. And when you look back, you're very justified to say should have been a Dodger. So those are the things that happen. There have been many, many stories about reports as far as Pedro's health. Dr. Job, the legendary doctor, once called me and said, "Fred, you never mentioned the fact that, you know, that I had concerns about Pedro's arm." And then I would tell him at the time, before any of it became public, I would say, Dr. Joe, he was a great, great friend. I said, your job is to give reports on the conditions of the players. No one does it better than you. No one helps our players more than you do. So that had nothing to do with that. So, again, there's only one summary to it. The trade of Pedro proved to be a terrible trade. Again, as a general manager, I think any general manager needs to take responsibility for the trades that are made.
Now, the biggest trade made during your tenure as GM was one that you weren't even involved in. It happened on May 15th, 1998, and it had Mike Piazza, the face of the franchise, along with Todd Zeal going to the Florida Marlins in exchange for Gary Sheffield, Charles Johnson, Bobby Bonilla, and Jim Eisenreich. This was shortly after Fox took over ownership and the new management in place made this move without your knowledge. What was your reaction when it happened, and did you have any idea something like this might occur?
Well, I had no idea it might occur because Fox, as you say, had just taken ownership. Fox had expressed concerns about Mike becoming a free agent at the end of the 98 year. I pointed out that there was plenty of time to deal with that, that Mike was an incredibly important player for us who should continue as a Dodger. I did have a call from Dave Dombrowski, who was, because of what was taking place in Miami, who was looking to move Gary Sheffield and Charles Johnson, the catcher, and Bobby Bonilla, because they were taking off dollars from their payroll in a significant way. My hope was that something might result where we could add Gary Sheffield to Mike Piazza. Can you imagine the power that the two of those would have presented for us back to back? And then came the absolute shock to me when I got a call from Bob Graziano, then the president of the team, saying that this trade had been made and needed to be announced. And I was totally upset by what had happened, that someone had really done this without ever asking me about this. And I said there would be two announcements then, because you certainly don't need me if this is the way the baseball operations are going to be run. And as it turned out, as history has recorded, the trade couldn't be completed because Gary Sheffield, as every general manager in baseball knew, but the Fox executive didn't know, had a no-trade contract. And so I wasn't going to leave in the middle of all of that storm and stayed on to resolve the contractual situation of the trade that had been made, to my knowledge, by Fox executive Chase Carey.
Upon leaving UM, you were relieved by the club, I think, a little over a month later. Could you at least kind of leave with your dignity intact? I mean, knowing that it would, as you said, it would probably be impossible to be in a position in which you were undermined so severely.
Well, I was willing to, the thing that happened, that I believe, and I was told by writers that the Fox people were very upset about, is I was very honest and straightforward, as I always was, that of how the deal came down. I told exactly what had happened, that I had received a call once we straightened out the contract with Gary and got rid of the no trade clause. This is how it happened. So from what the feedback that came to me was Fox was very upset that I would reveal so candidly what had happened. But that is what happened. So, at the point that I was fired, I believe it was June 21st of 1998, the one thing that I knew is that I had always given the best that I had to give every day that I was with the Dodgers. That encompassed a 30-year career with the Dodgers. So in any other situation in life, whether you're competing or whatever it is that you're doing, if you give the best that you have to give, and I certainly did, loved the job, loved the involvement, loved my 30 years with the Dodgers, but they made the decision to fire me, and so I could do nothing but accept that and move on to other things. And certainly look back at my career with the Dodgers, feeling that I was very, very fortunate to have had that opportunity, to have worked with wonderful people, to have spent 30 years in a game that I love, to have had the opportunity to be the general manager of the Dodgers, and, of course, to be able to share in the success that we had along the way.
That transition from the family ownership of the O'Malleys to the corporate ownership of Fox, what was the biggest difference you noticed once that change was made?
Well, the biggest difference is ownership made a trade. I mean, because I wasn't there that long to really see the full impact of what was going to happen. You have to recall that the Fox or the sale really took place, as I recall, in the spring of 1998 when it was approved. And Major League Baseball had concern about Fox, was assured that there would be a separation between the television business and the baseball business. That proved not to be true. There wasn't a separation. When the television people get involved in making baseball trades, you can't say there's a separation between the baseball business. And Rupert Murdoch actually was very candid. He went on PBS with Charlie Rose one day after they had sold the Dodgers to Frank McCourt. And he said, we've accomplished everything we wanted to accomplish with the purchase of the Dodgers. We established a regional television station or network in Los Angeles. So he's very, that was a very honest statement. It was a very open statement. Fox bought the team for television purposes. If you're going to buy a baseball team, buy it for the reasons of making the franchise as good as you can possibly make it. Buy it for all the right reasons. The obligation that you have to the fans, to the community that supports the team. So it was certainly although I was there just a very short time under Fox, as history was to show, it changed the structure of the organization in a dramatic way, from a family ownership to not only a corporate ownership, the corporate ownership that was really had a larger focus on the television and media business than the baseball business. That's about the biggest change you can make.
Yeah, you mentioned Frank McCourt. Once he put the team up for sale, I think it was in 2011, I know you were part of a group that put in a bid to buy the Dodgers. It eventually would be sold to a group headed by Magic Johnson. What led to you being part of that group?
Well, it's a fascinating story that really is probably the subject for another call at some point. Because of all things, there was a young man who had been a bat boy for the Dodgers, who went on to a very successful business career, who reached out to me to see if I would have an interest in his drive to buy the team. And I joined his group. His name's Ben Wang. And he had been very successful in business, had established a lot of great contacts, had felt that he could raise the capital to make a run to buy the team. Came to me, and I told him, after meeting with him and seeing the sincerity that he had and seeing the plan that he had, that I would help him. I, in turn, told Ben that we needed to bring in a couple of other people to help us in key areas if we were really going to make a full-out drive to buy the team. And we brought in Andy Dolich, a well-recognized executive with the Oakland Athletics, along with also in the NBA and even the NFL, and also had help from the former president of the Pittsburgh Pirates and San Diego Padres, Dick Freeman. So we formed a very solid team with probably as much or more baseball experience in the front office as any group that was bidding for the Dodgers. So we made a good run, and actually along the way connected with Mike Heisley, who had expressed an interest. He had owned at the time the Memphis basketball team, but of course, ultimately, Guggenheim took everybody out of the race with the offer that they made.
One recent development, significant recent development in Major League Baseball is the use of analytics. You're involved with the development of Scoutables, a smartphone application that provides scouting reports on players and is set to be launched at the start of the 2016 season. For those who access the app, what can they look forward to seeing when they use it?
If one goes to Scoutables, scoutables.com, they will see the analytics, the same type of analytics that are used by Major League teams and the decision that they make. This is the work of my partner, Ari Kaplan. The company was first branded several years ago as Ari Ball. We have now formed a partnership with a group in Pasadena, California, the Design Accelerator, to bring to our team some of the very top people in technology and in design. So we have on a beta test now. One can go to scoutables.com and pull up information on each and every major league player, see the type of analytical information that is used by the teams that will give the fans a really kind of a scout's view of what this player is all about. And so I think that that aids to, helps with the enjoyment of the game, or whether whatever depth of interest one has in baseball and the players, and we'll continue to improve this as we go through the season. But we're very excited because certainly the use of analytics, not only in baseball but in all sports, is growing in great, great strides, and we will be at the forefront of this.
Well, best of luck with that project, Fred, and thanks so much for spending a few minutes to talk. I really appreciate it.
Good to be with you.